Okay, Mark, this is only a question of curiosity. I am from old Europe, as Don Rumsfeld told us, so I need to know more about the structure of an American city. How stable are the neighborhoods of New Song community and the communities in New York? Are people just moving in and moving out every year, or is there some stability for a community? So how long will your New Song community sing the new song?
It depends on the city, how stable things are. Many American cities have emptied out. Baltimore was nearly a million people after World War II. A million people, and now there's about 650,000. There are 40,000 vacant houses in Baltimore City. 40,000. Everywhere you go, except for the Inner Harbor area, there are vacant houses. So a lot of instability because of depopulation.
Mm-hmm.
A place like New York, since September 11th, we've gained 100,000 new residents in the city.
New residents?
New residents. The population has continued to boom in New York City.
What is the reason for that?
New York City is a global city. It's connected to the world. There's jobs, there's friends, family.
Uh-huh.
So people come for the New York dream.
Uh-huh.
And they come for work. They come for to be artists. They come to be they come to get a new beginning in the country. They come from around the world.
Uh-huh.
So it depends on the city. It depends on the community. Harlem has historically had great stability, even though it has lost population.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
But now, with all the new population and all the money in New York, people are getting pushed out. The gentrification is a major factor. And that would be happening in places like Brooklyn, in parts of Manhattan, certainly in Harlem. So there is a constant struggle to hold on to Harlem.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends on the city, depends on, but I think people like to stay. There's long-term residents. People in Sandton have been there two and three generations in our church.
Oh.
So there's a lot of stability. People have been there many, many generations.
Uh-huh.
So it does vary, and people will stay in New York. It varies.
So the New Song community is a sustainable community?
I think so.
Good?
I think so.
Yeah.
At least there's no reason, and there's nothing before us that would say they don't have very important ministries for the next 20, 30, 40 years. Nothing to say otherwise.
Okay.
But changing communities, very, very changing places.
Yeah.
Lots of changes.
No, my question goes back to John Steinbeck on the Americans. Americans are men on the move. And the rootlessness of the American soul brings forth the footlooseness of the American legs, and the longing of every American is to have a home, while every American is moving from house to house every fifth year. So this was the reason. It may have changed now.
Well, New York is a gateway city. So people come to New York from around the world, and they may go somewhere else.
Yeah,
So New York is always changing, always, always changing.
Uh-huh.
But that's very different. There's no other city in the United States like New York.
Mm-hmm. Are Christian congregations then decline and new ones spring up?
There is exactly the case. There are many churches in Manhattan that are empty or don't have very large congregations on Sunday. But if you go to Queens or Brooklyn or the Bronx, the churches will be flourishing and claiming old abandoned warehouses or storefronts or basements. They're revitalizing neighborhoods and springing up all over the city. It's a very rich time in terms of religious life. Very, very rich time in New York.
So there is religion in the secular city.
New York may be the least secular city in the whole United States.
Whoa.
Because of, if you consider it in terms of people's religious commitments,
maybe
not in terms of how it affects public life, but in terms of religious adherence, all the new immigrants are bringing traditions of Christianity or Islam, and it is revitalizing the city. People are not leaving their faith behind. Their faith becomes more important.
Personally or in community? Religion, the religious thrust, is this more a personal thing or a community thing?
Let's take an African Christian. Yeah. They're going to find an African church. So that, as I mentioned, there are nearly 150 new African congregations in New York City.
Mm-hmm,
that's
mm-hmm.
extraordinary. And they represent every major strand of Christian development in Africa.
Yeah.
Catholic, Protestant, Pentecostal. And they're bringing their institutional lives.
Uh-huh.
So many of the churches have their headquarters for North America in New York City. At the same time, people are living their theology, living their faith, where they go to work, in their homes.
Uh-huh.
So adherence to a particular tradition in church life is very common, but also it's lived throughout how they go, how they ride the subway, how they work, what they say, what they do.
Do they come in groups, as the Puritans came and other Mennonites came? They came in groups and settled here somewhere, so the group was already together, or are they coming as individuals and then find the group or the congregation?
Due to factors of immigration law, they're primarily coming as individuals,
uh-huh.
and then they're finding each other. But then once one family member gets here, then other family members can come.
Oh, yeah.
On the other hand, sometimes because of war, there's been refugee resettlement. So, for example, Liberians or Sierra Leoneans
mm-hmm.
against Staten Island. That would be the exception. And because housing is so expensive, people tend to be... They may worship one place, but live somewhere else. And they may live in many different places.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, very rich time in New York. With a subway card, I often say with a subway card, you can travel to the churches of Africa on a Sunday morning.
If more questions are coming to my mind, I continue, but this is an open debate. What is the most secular city in the United States?
Well, maybe the most secular part of a city would be Manhattan in New York.
Also New York.
Part of Manhattan. Well, like, let's say down there, Wall Street.
Yeah,
often say that's the most secular part of New York.
And in the whole country? What would be the most secular city?
That's true. Because one of the biggest churches in New York City is in Lower Manhattan.
Right. You talking about Trinity?
Well, that would, Trinity. Do you know why you don't count them?
No, I didn't say that. No, I would just say that, by and large, people who come who are more secular, who are more... Definitely, I think even the pastors that are in that area would say that they feel it's the most secular part of New York City. Going by what the pastors in that area would say. They don't believe that there's not faith in people's lives, but in that part of New York where it's driven by business and commerce, they find that it is a more of a secular environment than, let's say, other parts of the city.
And I also think you can't really make it like New York is the least secular city in America, like based on what would that be? I mean, I'm just saying it's like there's a whole way of life in different parts of the country where it is so biblically based and religious that it's hard to step out of it and have a thought without people saying you're not Christian or you're not, you know, you don't meet some kind of standard. It's like, you know, those jokes, you know, the Buffalo Bible Belt. And that's what they call the South, the Bible Belt. And then in Nashville, we have the major publishers in the world where they have the Buffalo the Bible Belt. What happens is you have people on every corner, so anytime that you move
yeah, there's over 8 million people. I mean, New York is typically thought of as a secular city. I mean, Billy Graham, when he went to New York in the 50s, you know, talked about, I think it was, maybe I shouldn't say this further, but someone, a very famous evangelist, talked about Sodom on the subway, you know? And so there's this picture of New York as a very secular city. But in fact, there are tremendous amount of people of faith. The churches that are thriving are, there are something like 500 now Korean churches in New York City. No one, I think, can really count the number of Latino, Spanish-speaking storefronts. Well, I'm trying to contrast that with an image of New York as a secular city. In fact, it's a city where it's a center of mission from around the world. There are people from all around the world who are living their faith and worshiping. It's an extraordinary place for Christian religious life. And whereas this perception of New York as secular, it's a place of Wall Street and of Madison Avenue, and all these institutions which many people in the Bible Belt think promote the secularization of this country, right?
Well, I don't know.
Okay, so, but my argument would be that when people perceive New York, of these institutions that promote a culture of secularization and cultures of values that they don't appreciate, that is just a part of New York City. That's all I'm saying.
I totally appreciate that. I get that. I just thought you were saying, like, you know, some measure of what makes something the most religious or most secular.
It's a different picture of New York, a way of seeing New York as a place of extraordinary religious life, extraordinary revivals in different parts of New York where most people don't go and look and see. They don't really have much life outside of certain part of Manhattan. Most people don't cross into those other boroughs. I mean, it is amazing, the church life, and the work in evangelism, the work in discipleship, the work in sustaining all these new immigrants that happens, and the way that all these new immigrants are working in the jobs and are bringing their faith to bear in the workplace. So I think I'm not trying to say one, you know, waiting one city. Nashville is not, of course, the Bible Belt. Is exceptional that way.
The thing that Southerners find is that New Yorkers are provincial. That was a joke. that New Yorkers tend to make New York the kind of paradigm through which to see cities. And cities are, in America, have all different kinds of contrasting visions. I mean, in one city, there's a particular history behind, say, Nashville as opposed to Chattanooga, as opposed to Memphis. You're dealing with very different value systems, very different relations between churches and government. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. That's brought up. I mean, I think the whole idea of secularism is a kind of myth that Americans tell each other. Because you can't watch any kind of presidential address. I mean, things get stated in presidential addresses that would never be stated in a truly secular culture. What I think Billy Graham was reacting to was not secularism. It was a value framework that he didn't accept. It was pluralism that he didn't see. I mean, you don't think that Billy Graham was saying an accurate statement when he said he was going to a secular city. I mean, now in retrospect, I mean, there have been For 200 years, there have been vibrant religious communities, and not just Trinity in Wall Street, but in Lower Manhattan, you can find a number of churches.
Along the 200 years.
So do you think that Billy Graham is right when he characterized New York as a secular city?
Well, obviously he doesn't. He's been praising this community for the past.
I mean, I don't think New York City. I mean, I think I suggested. I don't think New York City is the paradigm for cities, but it is a different. It's not the paradigm for cities. Every city needs to be understood on its own terms and appreciated for it. But in some ways, New York is more like other cities in the world than, let's say, Nashville is in other parts of the world. Because New York City has diversity. It has the challenges of economic division. It has the multiple languages. These are the kind of issue that people in cities around the world have to face. And that may be increasingly true down south, but it's not been historically true. Whereas in New York, it is, you have to deal with the world. And I think that is a good environment for many things, really, for faith.
But Mark, isn't the way that you would want to frame it, not how secular it is or how religious it is, but is it a place you find shalom, right? Isn't is New York a place you find that, or is Nashville a place you find that? And
well, you know, one thing I have to throw in here, Joe Garibaldi, I don't know how many of you read years ago in his book, The Nine Nations of North America, and I think that is very true, so it's very difficult to answer this question that you posed, because I would say there are, his thesis was that the nine nations of North America are more different culturally than the European nations. But because you all speak different languages, then the assumption is that we're alike. And so the Nashville, New York, Hollywood, D.C., Miami, Chicago, Ohio, it would be very difficult, I think, to say which would be the most secular and which would be the least secular.
I mean, I used overstatements to just make a point about it.
This interchange leads me to ask a question to both of you, and it's about your perception of the trans-ecclesial work of the Spirit. Because that's what you're, in a way, you're pointing to, it seems to me. New Song is some evidence of the work of the Spirit ecclesially, but beyond. And I'm wondering how you're thinking about New York or your own city, Professor Moltmann, in terms of the work of the Spirit that is not that is concerned for the whole of humanity and is not ecclesially compatible. We've been talking about that in this whole conference, but this interchange makes me ask that question again.
Okay. Well, on the one hand, we expect to find the Holy Spirit in the church, where the word is preached and the sacraments are given. On the other hand, we must see that the church should be where the Spirit is. And the Spirit is not always bound to the word and the sacraments, but it can also be vice versa. You can also say it, we find Christ where the church is, but the church must be where Christ is. But where is Christ? On the one hand, where the word and the sacraments are given and the community of the faithful. On the other hand, according to Matthew 25, where the poor, the least of his brethren are, and that's mostly outside of the church, sometimes also inside. So we must look for the presence of Christ and know that where he promised to be. On the one hand, who hears you, hears me. On the other hand, who visits them, visits me. So there's a kind of a latent presence of Christ outside of the church. And if you can also put it in terms of the kingdom of God. To whom belong the kingdom of God? Well, we would say to those who believe, to those who expect and hope and love. But Jesus said to the children, to them the kingdom belongs. Whether they are children of believers or non-believers, just because they are children. And the same is true with the poor. They are already blessed because the kingdom belongs to them. It's not our property as Christians to have the Spirit, to have Christ, or to have the kingdom. The kingdom is inviting us, Christ is inviting us, and the Spirit is moving us out of what we know as a given church. This is a lesson we in Germany have to learn, because we have bound the Spirit to the Word. There was a time in Sweden when the Lutheran Church forbade a pastor to preach a free prayer. He has to read the prayer, because the Spirit is bound to the Word, the written Word. And you have to write down your whole sermon to bind the Spirit to the Word. While it is, can also be the other way around, according to Heidelberg Catechism, that the Spirit comes and then comes the Word. I think we must, even a practical term of a Christian community, have this exchange of Spirit and Word and Spirit better than we have had it in the past. This would be my answer. Now your answer.
I think a part of the story, as I look at things, and this is help me understand a little bit more about yesterday, when I talked about New York, the Church of Lord Almadora, and that is the center. If we think about the population center, maybe if we think about where the centers are of Christian growth and Christian vibrancy today, they're no longer in the West. The centers have shifted. Centers are in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And there are still many exciting things about the church here, African-American church, many great things, and your churches that we've heard about. We could say many important things here. But in reality, is the sheer numerical numbers are shifting from the West to the Global South. And these are where the issues and the leadership and the theological ideas that are so important to that part of the world are being generated. Now, with increased mobility around the world and a sense of borders changing and migration that's always been with us, but is speeding up a bit in this particular era, those movements are going around the world. So Latin Americans have missions to Europe. And to North America. And Koreans are planting churches in the former Soviet Union, in Russia. Wow. So it's happening all around the world that these new mission movements are taking place, because the population centers have shifted and people have a new energy and a new vibrancy. And I think that has potential, among many things it can accomplish, is to remind us that we are part of a larger body. As we know of these new communities, and I'm sure there's some not far from here, if not just as close as Washington, maybe even closer. It can remind us that we're part of a spirit which is working in many cultures and many languages and many cultural forms and expressions of worship, and are right among us, and we're part of a larger body. And the Spirit does not belong to one culture. The Spirit belongs to where God's people are around the world, and in fact, where the poor are and where God is at work redeeming all things.
With our congregation in the San Francisco there, we have basically, we've been in existence for about 22 years or so, and whenever folks want to become members of our congregation, we basically tell them that we're here for the long haul. In other words, if you become a part of our congregation, if you wanted to be a member, then you're committed to stay here in San Francisco. So that's why we give about a year and a half process to become a member, so that people really make sure that's what we want to do. I think that the reason behind that is that we really believe that the church can only be experienced if it stays put. I mean, if there's a presence on it, there needs to be a presence. It can't be a transient. Transient church is a transient presence. It's an oxymoron. So But I mean, so it's something that we have very much firmly lived by. It doesn't necessarily mean that there are certain circumstances that might uproot someone's, you know, not change, you know. But the whole premise there is that if we're going to be the church, we're going to be a presence in the city, we need to be here, we need to commit to being here for the long haul. So for that reason, we also are pretty small, because most people don't think that's sort of committed. But in light of what you were just saying about sort of the increasing transiency of the U.S. population, the global community, of changing borders and all that, you know, I would just love to get feedback from either of you as to how you feel about our church's posture. You know, is that a strength? You know, are there some weaknesses there? Are there ways that we are being too inflexible?
Now, who is a pastor?
Well, I mean, I think there in a global world, in a world that's more connected, the local matters even more.
Right.
And the local matters even more. I think it's never, and I think people know that. We could say a lot more theologically about how that works as well, and how we have this part of our identity which is always local, and part which is always a pilgrim people. But I think in terms of the moment that we live in, and you're in San Francisco, and LA would be other contexts where you'd have this, you know, sheer diversity, which is part of daily life in that city. We would want to say that being local is very, very important. And I think vows of stability as part of a new urban order has a lot of importance attached to it.
Well, originally, in the beginning of Christianity was a city religion from Corinth and Jerusalem and Rome, etc. And the people on the countryside were called pagans. In Germany, it's just the other way around now. The Christians live in the villages, in stable communities, and if they then move into the bigger cities, as Berlin or Hamburg, they become unchurched and without religious orientation anymore. So the pagans are living in German cities now. That may be completely different. But if this is true, then Christianity has a special chance in the urbanization of humankind today in the cities. And we should not transfer the model of a rural community, a village community, which at the same time a Christian community, to the city. And sometimes we did this, perhaps in the past, to have parishes where people live around a church. And some cities in Germany look like a conglomerate of villages. Well, I found it consoling to start with a confession of faith that we now confess our Christian faith together with the whole Christianity on earth. then we are a small group here and a small group there, and but we belong to the great Christian family all around the world, whether they are Methodists or Korean Presbyterians or whatsoever. In this confession of faith, we are one and a part of the whole of Christianity on earth. And therefore, we have a kind of solidarity with all the Christians on earth, which is stronger, sometimes at least, than the loyalty to my own country. So I'm, so to speak, a citizen of two kingdoms. One is the whole of Christianity on earth, the other is the state of Germany. And this was a very, very crucial question years ago when the Protestant Church Women United in Germany protested against the fruits of apartheid, which was against the economic interests of our own country, but in solidarity with the oppressed black Christians in South Africa. There was a point where this solidarity was stronger than the loyalty to one's own country.
I was going to just add something which may be a question, but from my limited grasp of sociology, what's different about the United States than European countries is the move of the population to the cities with the Industrial Revolution on didn't lead to a decline in church attendance. Actually, the opposite happened. Church attendance went through the roof. The American religion, Christianity we know today, though it kind of dresses itself up maybe as a liberal, it's actually an urban phenomenon. I don't know if that's something to disagree with. So how does that, this goes back to a question I asked a couple of nights ago, which was, first of all, a lot of your theology is addressing a church in decline because they're hanging on to an old closed system.
Mm-hmm.
In America, the church isn't in decline. It's in full health. We've got people arguing about which is the least secular city in America. but these cities are populated by very healthy, closed churches that are often outside the beltway and sort of being very happy and contained and not open to the other. I'd just like to hear maybe a reflection on that American experience of very successful but very closed churches.
Professor Molman,
no.
Just to add to that, I was been visiting some of these mega churches recently, and I had this conversation with a community organizer in Atlanta five or 6 weeks ago. I've been trying to get some of these large mega churches in the suburbs and in the exurbs, they're saying now, to engage some of the issues in the inner city. And so he approached one of the pastors of one of these large mega churches, and he was told that that we don't do justice. We outsource it to various smaller 501c3 organizations that are set up to do justice, but that's not part of our mission. So I never heard the phrase, we outsource justice.
But did you say it's not part of our mission statement?
It's not part of who we are. We outsource it to these other, you know, more niche ministries that do that in the city. So I didn't mean to derail that, but it's just sort of
I think that's
a further...
And what did you answer?
Well, my friend who was trying to solicit support went away very saddened by that. But there was no way of persuading him that this was contrary to the everything that, you know, the tradition teaches about the mission of the church and social order. But the success of these congregations largely depends on precisely that kind of market-driven identity. So you identify, you know, the constituents who are going to help the congregation flourish, and you eliminate all those who will create distractions and make the situation. situation somewhat murky and messy. Uh-huh.
Well, that's very human, but perhaps not Christian.
Well, then, I mean, but how do you, can you say more? I mean, that's an extraordinary thing to say.
But we don't have these mega churches in Germany, so I have not much experience with this. I know a mega church in Los Angeles, Crystal Cathedral, and another one in Seoul, the Yeouido Full Gospel Church. But at least the one in Korea is changing now from soul salvation to social salvation. Crystal Cathedral, perhaps not. But this is all my experience, so you may speak better to this problem. Right. Mm-hmm.
There is that rejoicing.
No, it's only recently that we discovered the theology of children, of the child. There's a big study done by Marsha Bunge and others on the child in the New Testament and etc. And I also, in the book I sent you, the beginning, I started with a child is born to us. In the end, the beginning. But why don't you respond to this question of the mega churches?
Well, it's interesting. Where are all the mega churches that you're visiting? Where are they? Are they in the cities?
No, we visited one in LA.
And so which? So they're in the cities?
Yeah, in the cities. But they're not only in the cities. They're in small, you know, smaller cities.
Are they in the suburbs or the
suburbs?
One factor is, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, I mean, if I was giving this talk 20 years ago, let's say, I would have said, except for the only church that really remained, the only institution which remained in the city of America was the African American church. In most neighborhoods, all you had left were the churches and funeral homes and beauty parlors and liquor stores, because all the other institutions had pulled out. Right, and this was, so the black church was the sustaining institution for our cities in so many ways. There was a statistic, and I don't know how the data was collected, but it was a number that if you calculate, if you look for evangelicals who were living in the United States, you know, and typically I think they meant white evangelicals, where they were living, less than 9% were living in the States. So this was 10 or 15, maybe 20 years ago. So This abandonment of the city, and the megachurch phenomenon is part of that. It's a search for a community which people have tried to reclaim because they've lost, you know, because we've lost what's so valuable about cities is that we are with diverse people. We're near grocery stores we can walk to. We don't have to drive a long way. So there's something about the megachurch that, of course, is very much trying to recover. A lot of things are very important. There was a very interesting article in the New York Times Magazine a few weeks ago. Did you see this? Mm-hmm. And basically the question there was, he wanted, if I have this right, the pastor wanted people to be able to say, or a parishioner asked, when you come to their church, they're such a full service provider that where's the movie theater? They wanted it to be like a mall. And I think that is still trying to, in some ways, maybe that church is good, and I'm not offering to teach of that congregation as much as there is in the megachurch trying to substitute for many megachurches, for many of the megachurches. There's a way to substitute things that we have lost in as we've abandoned cities and done different ways of living in the human community in the United States. That's part of the reason for it. Part of the reason. There are, of course, some of the largest churches. The largest churches are in cities, or African-American churches that we rarely know about. Redeemer's 5,000. There are much larger churches in New York City than Redeemer that people know about, definitely Redeemer. But there's Christian Cultural Center, there's Floyd Flakes, there's all kinds of things happening that we don't know about, in part because we only look for certain things that we know.
Rauschenberg's critique of American Protestantism was too much focus on individual salvation and losing the focus on the new creation of communities, the movement of the Holy Spirit, redemption, justice, and all those things. Isn't it only the natural extension of that critique that there's this sort of consumerization movement in the church, and that consequently you would find the question, well, where's the theater, or we outsource justice ministries? I mean, isn't that just the natural progression of that old mind?
I'm not sure. I mean, again, my comments about that maybe takes a different path. There is a struggle with that, but I think there's many huge churches which are, many churches which are vibrant and very important. And it's not a critique of size or that. The full gospel church in Korea is, what, 800,000?
Yeah, right.
800,000 people in Korea.
But the mystery is they have 55,000 house cells. So the congregation or the church consists of smaller communities.
Right.
It's not just a stadium like a crusade of Billy Graham every Sunday.
Very vibrant, exciting things happening. I didn't want to seem as if I was saying large churches are run. It can be wonderful expressions of the kingdom of God.
No, and I didn't hear that. What I'm saying is what's exciting about the model you put forward in New Song and what's going on in New York, et cetera, is the rediscovery of the more primitive idea of the church as this living faith community. It is, in a sense, sort of the new creation, the kingdom, in my opinion. And I see this consumerization model that seems to have afflicted and infected the American church. It's why we're arguing over what's the most secular or what isn't the most secular, yet a lot of the churches that pass for churches in my environment, the question of justice ministry, not even megachurch, but just the local churches, there is no justice ministry going on. It's all about individual salvation and making sure that you're not heathen like all the other people outside the doors of the church.
Well, obviously, there are not many heathens left in America.
Their numbers are growing. And a year and a half ago, my local newspaper editorial, I just became sort of a frustrating part of this experience in my world, that you could not be a Christian and be a liberal. It just wasn't possible. I demanded an apology, but and I got one. That's the division. Now, Senator Frist has taught me that I was wrong.
Can I just build on that? I'm sorry to talk so much here, but this is very much related to a question I wanted to ask you, Mark, or a comment I wanted to make in response to your presentation, and that is, how do you avoid, as a member of New Song,
the partisan spin that would make of such a story, you know, a lesson in pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you know, entrepreneurialism. And we've discussed the megachurches and their lack of justice. Nonetheless, we know they're increasingly part of the political machinery that elects conservative politicians in the United States. And it seems to me, as a member of you know, a beloved community such as New Song, you have a certain kind of moral and theological authority to teach us lessons about not just bearing witness, but about policy and policy recommendations that the churches need to be discussing. And so I guess two questions. How do you articulate, you know, a strategy of political resistance, but moreover, how do you articulate particular recommendations for changing policy in the neighborhood and in the nation, and in the cities and in the nation?
I mean, I think we always want to be listening and learning from every other church. I mean, I want to say that. I don't think New Song has a corner on, you know, what we've learned or still have to learn. But, you know, in the 80s and 90s, you had to argue, you were arguing against a certain perception of, let's say, the welfare mother. Mm-hmm. There was a great hatred based on of people of color, especially women and children, because they may have had public services, and there was a lot of stereotypes which were being perpetuated. I think today, you almost have no discussion of that. And I think the witness of New Song would be that the poor are still with us. I think there is just you find it hard to find a policy book now in the bookstores about inner city poverty. It's as if it's gone, but it's not. And in fact, studies which have been done have shown, let's say with the welfare reform, they've shown some successes, but a lot of things that have not been successful. And I think that the witness of a church like New Song or any other church that is in a marginal situation is to bear witness in this culture that the poor are still with us here in America. And our work is not done. I think that, and I think you have to begin again, and it's even a policy matter. Yeah, I think it's a very different time now. Which I would, it's hard to believe, but that's what I feel. That's what I feel right now.
I also think we need to be careful when we start to talk in a very stereotyping way about any aspect of the church, even those that we so heartily disagree with. And the question becomes, when we lump mega churches into the category of the other, you know, what line are we drawing? Is this like over 300 people? Is this under 300 people? And could there never be a contextualized megachurch that actually was moving very much in the direction of God's justice? And my challenge to people who have approached megachurches and gotten the response, you have right to walk away. Walk right back in there. Because they are still our brothers and sisters, even if they are, as I said before, renegade churches. We have no excuses for letting people off the hook. It is not loving to decide that somebody is so beyond understanding that they could not be challenged in love. I would also like to say that I became a Christian at Redeemer, and it brought me to a place where I very much was thinking about justice issues, and I'm now a Catholic. So there is no predictable journey. And I certainly defy any categorization. So
my problem with that ultimately is that it seems that to generate any kind of longstanding vision of justice requires a kind of appreciation for the church as an institution and an ecclesiology that could recognize the benefits of working within the framework of an institution, which perhaps, in some ways, and I don't want to ever tread in someone else's spiritual space, maybe there might have been something to your movement towards the Catholic Church other than, say, the Eucharist, which would be a good reason, I'm sure. So I'm wondering if there needs to be some kind of grappling with an ecclesiology that can recognize the benefits of, say, the endurance of an institution from generation to generation, and how that can maybe help develop a tradition of thought, some learnings that can be passed on from one generation to another.
Well, I don't know. For me personally, the church is the congregation, and all the superstructures are just auxiliary to the congregation, where the people meet, face-to-face community. The rest is cyber church. I like this face-to-face communities where we can speak face-to-face. So perhaps this is a preference for small is beautiful, but I have nothing against mega churches if they consist of smaller communities, which then come together to a larger community. But just an audience, audience churches, as we have it in Germany, you go on Sunday morning to church, you say not a word, you listen to what the preacher says, then you look around whether you know somebody, then you go home, and that's all. This is not very enjoyable.
The problem with those, small is beautiful. The problem, though, is it seems that that ecclesiology of the sect led to a kind of privatization of religion in America, which stands in some ways behind the development of a megachurch that has no social conscience, because it's not accountable to wider structures. It doesn't see itself as operating within real networks as opposed to imagined networks and media.
Well, it must not necessarily become a sect. A sect emerges if you say, we are here, the good ones, the elected ones, and there's a bad world. If this is a condition for a congregation, then the sectarian danger is very close. On the other hand, we have in Europe churches who only consist of institutions. And if you look at the basis, there is nobody anymore.
Right.
They only have these institutions and representatives. And this is not, how would you call this? That's another type of sectarianism. Yeah.
But you have to choose?
No, normally not.
We have to break here.
We need to thank you so much. And I think we can.
Thank you.